This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hi, I'm Barry Brook. I work at the University of Adelaide on climate change issues, and I was also involved with the Equinox 2030 summit, which Wilson is going to tell you about today, a very exciting event that took place in Canada earlier this year. I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the lands of the Kaurna people, the traditional owners of this land, and I'd like to welcome you all to this Adelaide Festival of Ideas event. Now, although you have to switch your mobile phones to silent, you can still tweet, and we would encourage that. The hashtag for the event and the Adelaide Festival of Ideas is #AFOI, and the Twitter account is @IdeasAdelaide. All right, let's get on with it. I'd like to introduce our speaker, who was one of the people who came up with the idea of the event and helped coordinate the Equinox 2030 summit, Wilson De Silva, who's editor-in-chief and co-founder of Cosmos magazine, the Australian literary science magazine. Now, he was formerly an on-air reporter at the ABC, and he served as president of the World Federation of Science Journalists, and he's a winner of 31 awards in science journalism, which is very impressive, and that includes the AFI Award for Best Documentary, 2 Editor of the Year trophies for his work at Cosmos, and before that he worked at newspapers such as the Sydney Morning Herald and as a technology writer at The Age. He's also worked as a foreign correspondent for Reuters and was science editor at ABC Online and a former Sydney correspondent for New Scientist, so he's really done it all. So I'd like to introduce Wilson De Silva to hear more about the Equinox 2030 Summit.
Thanks, Barry. You make me sound like 100, but that's because I actually am. Can I say how impressed I am that a discussion about the next 20 or 30 years of energy attracts such a crowd? I'm very impressed. But we are in Adelaide, which is the home of the Festival of Ideas, so it's appropriate, isn't it? We have a populace who's interested in ideas. And one of the ideas that has emerged came out of an experiment that Barry and I were involved with. It was an experiment, I've got to say, I found transformative and found a great pleasure to be involved with. And we hope you'll be hearing about it next year when the rollout of the results start. So what happened with this experiment? What is the Equinox Summit Energy 2030? We brought together scientists, policy people, technical experts, entrepreneurs, and young people to discuss how we might achieve a massive reduction in humanity's contribution to climate change using only the transformative power of science and a heady dose of critical thinking. Sounds simple, doesn't it? The goal was to address the challenge from a scientific perspective first and foremost, and then factor in the economic, social, and environmental implications before arriving at a series of practical and actionable recommendations. The political dimension, while important, was actually left until last. So often, it seems that it's the other way around. So we thought this was worth a try. We hope this approach might provide a path through the confusing and competing priorities, many of which can be coloured by political concerns. Thank God, it's the end of the technical problems. Where we thought science could contribute is in finding ways of reducing further warming. Since energy supply makes the largest global contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, it was decided that our 5-day meeting would focus on energy, in particular, the generation, distribution, and storage of electricity. Why electricity? Well, the world is becoming increasingly electrified. Electricity is the world's fastest growing form of end-use energy consumption and forecast to grow steadily. Net electricity generation worldwide will grow at 2.3% per year to 2035, well ahead of the demand for other forms of energy. In most advanced economies, electricity makes up the largest proportion of energy use, as you can see from the graph. The graph shows the United States and primary use by sector, and this is relatively common in most industrialized countries. In the decades ahead, the price of oil is expected to rise further, accelerating the current trend for the growing electrification of transport. That's cars, buses, and mass transit. Hence, by 2030, we think, and everyone's forecasting, that electric power will actually represent an even larger proportion of world energy consumption. Now, the experiment that we created was the Equinox Summit, and it was staged by the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, or WGSI, a non-profit foundation created in 2009 so that science could be brought to bear on pernicious and difficult problems in global problems in society and civilization. WGSI is actually a partnership between Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the nearby University of Waterloo, both just outside of Toronto in Ontario. The meeting was held over 5 days in June 2011 at the beautiful Perimeter Institute building. I'd been hired 18 months earlier to lead the team that would select the participants, establish the model for this bold undertaking, and then, to make sure I had skin in the game, moderate the discussions and help ensure we deliver the results. So, on the line. But first, about a little bit about the unusual model we employed, which turned out to be actually essential to get the transformation results we attained. We brought together scientists proposing novel, out-of-the-box ideas that were thought to have real transformational potential. They were called the Quorum. We then had advisors, senior people drawn from policy, industry, academia, science, business, a wealth of backgrounds, mostly older, seasoned, and ready to punch logical holes into the ideas. Among them was Barry Brook, who's here today. The magical ingredient, however, was a collection of 19 amazingly bright, thoughtful, and very sharp young people, mostly aged in their 20s, who had been selected from around the world as emerging leaders in public policy, industry, and civil society. In total, we had 40 people from 17 countries who came together over 5 days to consider radical solutions to removing carbon from the electricity supply. Technical problems continue. I'll just continue until we load this up. Another unusual element of this model was that we had private closed-door meetings under Chatham House rules, and I'll explain that in a minute, and public plenaries. One of the other unusual, we had public plenaries under Chatham House rules, and which were broadcast nationally on TVO, a Canadian public broadcaster. We had a group of invited journalists in the room from various outlets around the world who could observe the process at close range and report on what was discussed, but not who said it. That's Chatham House rules. All of us were aiming to present on the fifth day a selection of transformative technologies that we believe held the potential, or might hold the potential, to rapidly accelerate the transition of our electrical energy supply with zero dependence on fossil fuels. It's a massive, massive ambition, but not as much of an ambition as getting PowerPoints to work across Mac versus PC platforms, it seems. Steve Jobs, you're an incredible guy, but man. So here's the challenge that we were facing when we began the meeting. Global energy consumption is about 16.5 terawatts. Now, that's 1 million watts, 1 terawatt, or 10 watts followed by 12 zeros. It's a lot, right? So that's the world energy consumption. About 2.5 terawatts of electricity is from non-carbon sources, mostly hydro and nuclear. By 2050, it is forecast that we will need 30 terawatts. So, as you can see, we kind of need to double energy production, kind of, and if we were to reach the targets that we need to try and stabilize emissions, we kind of need all of that to be from non-carbon sources. Now, we know that's not true. We know that China alone is building, over the next 30 years, thousands of coal-fired power stations. 12 have been approved in Australia for the next 20 years, next 10 years. So, we know that's not the case, and that coal-fired power stations in particular are the most noxious when it comes to the contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, gas less so, about 50% less. So we're not going to be able to meet this target and stabilize emissions. So you can see the challenge that we as a society face and why it wasn't simple and why it is a lot of these meetings haven't been successful. But hey, what did we do? Well, we did something else. We rethought the problem. We broke down, firstly, we concentrated on one form of energy, which is electricity, and we had people from all over the world, different perspectives, and we broke it down into generation, distribution, and storage. Within generation, we looked at a mix of technologies that might be able to address the generation component. While it says there's solar, wind, geothermal, and nuclear, within that there were several different types of technologies that were considered. With the distribution, we looked at superconductors, at smart grids, and in storage and industrial and consumer solutions. Then we looked at societal needs. What do we need? Well, we need to decarbonize civilization. We need to address efficiency. We need to address access to electricity. You know, there are 2.5 billion people who don't have access to electricity. And we need security, as in certainty of access and affordability, obviously. So we broke so we had this approach, and we broke it down into three ways of thinking about it. The rural remote needs, which can be quite different from urban needs, urban and industrial, and electrified transportation, which is can be deployable in both. And what we came up with was a really, really different way of seeing electricity. We created something that we call the low-carbon electricity ecosystem. We rethought the whole process, the whole enchilada, in a different way, as actually an ecosystem. We looked at baseload. Those of you who are familiar with energy would know, for electricity in particular, know that you need baseloads, that when we all get up in the morning and flick on the lights or to put on the kettle, that it all kind of works, because there's a constant stream of electricity, of energy coming down the wire. And baseload is reliable, which is the challenge with wind and solar and other renewables, because they are sporadic. They can be less reliable. Then they may not be there when we need it. It's great when the sun coincides with air conditioning use, because when it's hottest is also when you need air conditioning, but the wind doesn't necessarily do that. So coal, gas, nuclear, oil, kind of reliable, stored energy, that's what you need. That's baseload. So we looked at three approaches to baseload, which would cover the big heavy hitter, the reliable energy you need there all the time. We looked at smart urbanization. What can we do to smarten up our cities to make them more efficient, but also make them more livable for all of us? The electrification of transport is actually a subset of that, because it actually required a great deal of focus. And rural electrification, we came up with a very interesting approach to creating microgrids. So, what does this all mean? Ah, there's a font issue. Sorry about that. So, we came up with on the baseload side, we had three approaches. One was a short term, 2012 to 2022, and that's renewables coupled with large-scale storage. Again, addressing baseload. Now, here's the challenge with land use requirements for electric power generation. As you can see, biomass, hydroelectric, where you've got to flood large areas to actually hold your backed-up energy. That's, releasing that water is what powers the turbines. And then you've got wind, and there's a lot of land use requirement, the land use demands for renewables, and it's something to consider. So you can't just cover the planet with wind turbines. Even though they can often be benign, they can also sometimes be not so benign. There's also what I mentioned before, the stability of when you need it. Sometimes the winds actually don't blow when you most need them. Hydroelectric power, too, has an issue. I don't know what has been the case in Adelaide, but certainly in Melbourne and Sydney, we've had horrendous droughts that have actually eaten into the Warragamba Dam and places like that, which we rely on a lot for our electricity. So long places that, you don't have predictability, even though it's a large amount of water behind a dam, it may not actually be predictable over the longer term. Wind also has quite wild swings, and there's actually patterns over long periods of time, over many, many years. It seemed to be cycles of wind intensity, so that's not quite as predictable. Solar, incredibly spiky, as you can see there. Lots of cloud can have a dramatic impact. And what you see on the where it says firm power on your lower right is what basically everyone else does. If you've got wind, which is incredibly spiky, as you can see in the blue graph, gas is turned on to fill the holes and provide the electricity that you need. So What you could do is actually store it. And there are a number of technologies that exist, but some really exciting new ones that we're arguing for mass deployment. So what you've got there is you've got your wind power, you've got your solar, as two examples of renewables, and you've got your central power plant. That feeds into a storage device, ESS, it's common called. I think that stands for Energy Storage Scheme. Anyway, it's used in the industry as a term. So what you have is, irrespective of how you store it, whether it's batteries that we're familiar with, on a larger scale, or some kind of physical ESS, and I'll show you what I mean by physical ESS, and that provides a load to the customer. So there's an example of a pumped hydro, where basically you pump water up, and then you release it as you need it over time. It's kind of a different way of storage. Another way is compressed air ESS, where you pump air into a vault underground, and then as you need it, the pressure drives turbines on the way back out. There are examples around the world of this sort of thing. It's a way of keeping storing energy in large quantities. But what would really be the absolute killer would be to capture that energy and hold it on demand, not necessarily have to expend a great deal of energy storing that energy, which is what you do with compressed air and with the large-scale water storage. And there are actually a number of battery technologies, generally known as flow batteries, that show real promise for large-scale storage of electricity. Now, when I say large-scale, I mean a battery the size of this room. And I don't mean a battery that has, and it has vats of liquid in it. It's not quite a traditional battery that we're familiar with, the lead-acid battery, which actually dates back to the U.S. Civil War, the 1850s. So it's very old technology, and we've done remarkably well extending the life of it and making it more and more efficient, but ultimately we're kind of stuck in the 1860s. And what these batteries are, these flow batteries, they use some different mixes for different types, but they can store large quantities of electricity produced at a power station and then bled out over the rest of the day. The attraction here would be, obviously, you can see that if the sun is shining and there isn't as much demand for that power, you can capture it and then release it at night. Or when the wind's not blowing, you can actually... So you actually, the spikes that you get in electricity, you can actually smooth them out a little bit. And one of the technologies that's really exciting is actually from Australia. It's vanadium redox batteries developed at the University of New South Wales. There are actually demonstration projects around the world installed, and they're doing well. It's still early days of technology. What we need is to de-risk the technology and make it large scale. And that's what. And the cool thing about this is you can use it like petrol, because the flow battery, the liquid, is charged, and then you pump the charged liquid into a vessel, which is a storage tank, fuel tank, and off you go. So there's some real promises here, but the costs are prohibitive at the moment. And what we've argued for is a large-scale test of these technologies. Install in wind and solar farms around the world large examples of flow batteries, vanadium redox being amongst them, to de-risk the technology, bring down the costs, and basically allow renewables to suddenly be a reliable part of the chain for energy production. So that's what we're proposing there. In the medium term horizon, we're looking 2014 to 2025, we're looking at geothermal. We're looking at, there are actually a number of programs for geothermal around the world, but we're looking to expand, upscale, and de-risk the technology. Geothermal is an extraordinarily large resource capable of providing significant proportion of global energy demand. It comes from the heat of our planet. Our planet has been quite hot deep down below in the core, and has been since it was created 3.5 billion years ago. So the challenge is trying to get at those hot spots. And the way that you kind of need to drill about 3 to 6 kilometers. And the way that people have been using geothermal up until now is kind of finding where the cracks are and, trying to run power plants that way. The problem is sometimes the cracks are in out-of-the-way places, which aren't very convenient for energy use. But there are a number of projects. There's actually a plant going live in Germany scheduled for January 2010, a 10-megawatt plant, which, you know, is drilling down to try and find fracture areas in the crust where the heat is actually coming up through the cracks. And they can actually, you know, run a proper power plant. The attraction here is that it's free energy. It's not even, you don't have to worry about clouds. The Earth is always hot and has been for billions of years, so it's relatively reliable. And we believe that it's going to be somewhat hot for quite a few billion years to go. The challenge is that in geothermal, it's not considered, where it's considered a business in the sense of a mining business, you're not extracting something. You're kind of extracting heat. Whereas oil, you're digging out, you're drilling down and taking out oil, you take something physical. This, what you're actually doing is trying to find a hot spot. So you might need to drill 30 or 40 holes, and each hole might cost $1 million because these drill bits are expensive. And then you find the bit in the, say if there's a sandstone layer, you find where the crack is that you need to reach. And once you've found that, all the other holes can be used to send water down, cold water, and then steam comes out the other end, and you've got a power plant. So theoretically, if we can get the mining technology improved, if we can get the drill bits better, bring down the cost, and de-risk it, companies should be able to invest in this and think, wow, you can do energy anywhere. So there you go. There's currently 10 gigawatts, and the potential is for 10% of baseload power by 2030. If there was a program to really go down the geothermal path, we could actually cut a lot of carbon emissions and deliver a lot of free energy. The investment is largely the drilling. Once you've done the drilling, there ain't that much to it, really. We propose 10 large-scale demonstration projects around the world, a multi-government approach. Australia should be part of that. It has a lot of expertise in this, particularly in South Australia. And we have a lot of people who have understand this area, and we can contribute along with Canada is also very good at this, the Russians. What we need is to prove that this is doable on a large scale, not just 10 megawatts, but 10 gigawatt single capacity or a 20 gigawatt plant. You know, why it should theoretically be possible, but you know, it won't happen unless people bite into it. Okay, so there you are, 10 to 20 projects over 3 years, $1 billion fund. And we actually proposed, Perimeter Institute was delighted, I think. We proposed that actually they host a meeting of geothermal experts from around the world to actually talk about creating this this international $1 billion fund to advance geothermal research. Okay, now nuclear. This is the long term. Now, you might say, well, if you've got geothermal and you've got a reliable renewables, why do you need nuclear? Because if everyone lived like Australians do today, we would need 10 times the amount of power generated. And it's not unreasonable to expect that as the world industrializes, that people will demand the kind of ease of use and access to power that we have today. And that's going to be a serious challenge. Even with deploying coal-fired power plants, even with deploying all of the renewables, we're still not going to bridge that gap that's going to be there, particularly, I think it's 2040 to 2070. There's a huge spike in demand. And the only way you can deliver, well, we argue, and we did a lot of discussion, I think Barry certainly agreed with us, the only way you could deliver this large, satisfy this large demand, put aside the issue of efficiency, even if you went hell for leather on efficiency, you're not going to cover this massive spike. You're not going to compensate for this massive spike. So how do you do it? You do it with nuclear. But the team, which included a lot of young people, were not really sold on nuclear, and they were really, really antagonistic to nuclear. But we had some really interesting examples, and Barry contributed a lot to this. We looked at closed fuel cycles, particularly a Generation 4 reactor style. I think it's called Integral Fast Reactor, ISF, Integral Fast Reactor, which basically produces no waste. You put a chunk of, it's a uranium-plutonium mix, I think, and you put a chunk into it, and it just keeps recycling the fuel. Closing the fuel cycle has been a kind of a utopia that a lot of people have been aiming for a long time. When basically how reactors work now is they're kind of there's the core of uranium or plutonium, and they're a nuclear bomb trying to go off, and which was why they're a bit of a challenge. And then you try and keep them cool at 1.0 criticality, so they're constantly hot enough, really super hot, to drive your turbines, but they're not so hot that you have a runaway nuclear reaction. So the relationship is testy, yeah, with the current design. Some of the really interesting designs, and it produces piles of waste, although it has to be said, every gram of uranium, you generate massive amounts of electricity, and certainly you don't produce any of the emissions that coal does into the atmosphere, which also go into our lungs and get stuck in plaques in our bloodstream and lead to, at least in the US, 26,000 deaths a year that would otherwise not have happened. So closing the fuel cycle was really attractive, and we're talking about there again another demonstration plane, in this case for one super integral fast reactor to prove the concept, take it to really the nth degree, and then deploy integral fast reactors around the world so that no new nuclear reactors are built unless they're integral fast reactors, having better down the technology and made it work. But even better, and this was very, very exciting, people were saying, well, what happens with all the waste we've created so far? The 20-year-olds would make sure that we wouldn't forget the legacy that would be left for them to take care of. And they were really sold on thorium, accelerator-driven thorium reactors, which basically, instead of having a bomb at the core trying to blow up, you have you have thorium in the core, and it never quite gets to criticality, so you just throw in old nuclear waste and fire an accelerator, and it cooks it all up. So it burns the waste. And I think Yasin Kandi was saying we had enough nuclear waste to power the Earth for 5,000 years. It was pretty cool. So you could actually use waste as a process. So that gets around base load. And then we went into this is the kind of stuff making cities energy smart can be done tomorrow. We know that we're going to have 6 billion people on the planet by 2025. We know the buildings emit 7.5 gigatons of CO2 equivalent to about 1.5 billion cars. We need to make our infrastructure intelligent so that none of that energy is wasted. And there are a whole bunch of proposals around building design, around the building of how it is that we, mobility, how it is that we get around. Urban transportation was fantastic. A lot of interesting ideas came out of there, and a lot of it's stuff that we can implement tomorrow. It's superb. They again looked at it, 3 billion people in 2005 in the developing world. It's going to go to 6 billion. We're going to have an additional 3 billion people in the developing world. How do we do it? Do we want this sort of world of Jakarta and Shanghai with smoggy cities? No, we don't. We have an opportunity here where these cities are rapidly industrializing. Why don't, instead of them industrializing the way we did, where we did it kind of wrong, really, but we didn't know any better, why not industrialize it in such a way that's quite smart? So having an integrated transportation system, which would allow you to have the option, if you're going from one place to another, you actually have mass transit, or you have a subscription car that you sign up to, or you might have a personal vehicles, but there's actually a range of stuff, and it allows you to go from point A to point B, wherever point B is, using a number of solutions. The whole point is to get to provide mobility, because if you boil it down to it, you don't really need a car necessarily. What you need is what the car provides, which is transport. So let's rethink that idea. And then they looked at some other ways of doing that. Now, rural electrification, this was the most exciting development because it was totally unexpected. We really felt a little bit guilty that we were dealing with solutions that would address the people who have electricity, but we were kind of leaving out the people who don't have electricity. And one of the technologies proposed, actually a couple of them, so there's 2.5 billion people there who don't have electricity. One of the technologies turned out to be, it was an organic, plasticky, photovoltaic cell. Wasn't all that attractive because the efficiency was very low, 8%. But guess what? And this is where it helped having people from different parts of the world. While it wouldn't be attractive to you in Australia or to Canadians in a developed metropolitan environment is incredibly attractive to someone who has to carry kerosene on their back for 10 kilometres to power lights at their house. So we looked at the cycle. This is the transitional graph that made us realize that we were seeing it from the first world and we didn't realize what the problem was. You have, as you get urban scale, you demand low-cost electricity. But at the other end, where you're in a subsistence, where you have difficulty making ends meet and you're in a rural setting, you're willing to pay, your willingness to pay for electricity is much higher. You already pay ridiculous amounts to access that. So why not provide this solution, which you might say is relatively expensive, but actually, delivers all your needs at lower cost. So we looked at some examples. It's actually a market opportunity to deliver this. This technology is kind of 2-3 years away from deployment. I wonder if we've got an example of it. I think we did. Let me just have a look. Oh, yes, there it is. See the solar panels on the thatch roof? They're flexible. They're just flexible like mats. You can do almost anything to them. And the cool thing is you can also reverse them so that they generate light at night. So you could, now they're not going to be good for every type of, the efficiency isn't there for every type of solution. You can do lighting communication like charging your mobile phone. You can do refrigeration and some small scale refrigeration and TV, but you can't do cooking and water heating. That would be larger proposals. We looked at solar hydrogen. I won't go into detail, but we looked at other solutions. That what we basically looked at was creating a microgrid, a grid that that you could have a local community where you can draw on the electricity for large scale, more intensive demands like heating and cooling, but the running of the lights and charging your mobile phone doesn't have to rely on that. Okay, just rush through now because, and yes, we think that by 2030 you could deliver 500 million households, and how you do it is actually partnering with people who have a need for this sort of thing, like the UNHCR. When they go into a crisis zone, they actually truck in diesel generators, and so do the army, to deliver electricity. If they had large-scale deployment of this technology, they would de-risk it and bring down the costs and allow us to then deploy it, or the developers, to deploy it to the 500 million households who need it. So there you go. There's the... I just rushed through basically the low-carbon electricity ecosystem that we're proposing. The teams who are involved in this, so there are 40 people, are writing up those results into a large-scale, a large report, a book, which will come out in January this year, and it will be we're going to take it to the World Economic Forum in Davos and the World Future Energy Summit in Abu Dhabi, and then eventually to the UN Conference of Sustainable Development in Rio in May 2012. It's the if you remember the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, this is Rio Plus 20, they're calling it. We think this presents a plan that would allow, in the numbers that the people who are involved with this, much more experienced than I am and understand this field, would allow us to decarbonize electricity production globally this century. That's the exciting thing about it. This isn't dreamland blue sky stuff. This is actually logical. As you can see from the last example, there were clear market opportunities there that certainly the entrepreneurs and the industry people who were involved, which included the former chief technology officer of Rio Tinto, Robin Batterham, they were really excited by it. They could see opportunity and it's interesting. You know, a lot of these discussions about energy and climate change and reducing our emissions are always around targets. Here are the targets, and everyone argues about how to reach those targets. We took a completely different path. We said, let's look at interesting technological pathways that are low carbon, and let's explore how far you can take them in an integrated approach, not a 3-year political cycle approach, not a 5-year, but, you know, thinking 20, 30, 40 years into the future. And guess what? It's totally doable. You just have to want to do it. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Wilson. We should also mention on the Equinox website, wgsi.org, there's an example of, well, there's a discussion of what we did in more detail, which is like a primer of the summit, which is something to have a look at before the main book comes out, because it does describe in overview a lot of the technologies and pathways that Wilson discussed today. But
it's up on the screen, wgsi.org.
And it's like a 10-page document, is that right? And
so it's called the Equinox Communique, but there's also videos you can watch of the public sessions. Remember I said there were public sessions? At the opening of each day, there were kind of public sessions. You can watch videos of the whole thing. It was you can experience it if you were there.
And there was a TV series in Ontario which covered each night the summit, and it was like Q&A on ABC, but done with intelligent panelists, and so it was really interesting thing to listen to each night.
Only when you were on, Barry.
All right, let's take the opportunity of the time we have remaining, which is just over 10 minutes, to get some questions from you guys, either about the technological details or the overview plans. We'll start off at the front.
Thanks very much. Just a quick question about the Equinox Summit. What you've talked about
can be summarised as supply side, so the supply of the energy market. Was there any consideration given to demand side, so reducing demand, given that we've had a PM task force in Australia say that we can reduce energy use by about 30% with minimal impact on quality of life or economy?
Totally agree. We would not have gone through it, and the some of the industry experts and the certainly the forum, the young people, would not have let us got away with it. I'm trying to summarise 5 days' worth of discussions, but actually that making cities energy smart is actually all about that. It's about efficiency, and there were substantial gains to be made. I mean, buildings, for example, are stunning, the amount of gains you can make on buildings, just by building them smarter. Not even if you didn't retrofit buildings, if you just new buildings, I mean, it makes a massive contribution. So, yeah, it will cover that.
It's on. Did the group consider community-owned energy companies, i.e. if a block, a suburb got together, stuck a whole lot of solar panels in, a couple of wind turbines and a battery, why wouldn't they then run their own company?
I don't think we looked at that, but we did look at some community initiatives for the developing world. It was considered that what was needed was to come up with a microgrid approach, whether it involves solar hydrogen for large-scale energy operation, but certainly it begins with the organic PV, if you like, stage one. Stage two is solar hydrogen a storage battery, which then becomes a local grid, that might be owned by a community. But what it was felt was we need to bring the technology, make the technology work in a microgrid situation, bring the cost down dramatically, and then you have something that you can pick up and deploy anywhere around the world. And it doesn't just have to apply to the developing world. It has the biggest application would be in the developing world, but actually it would apply anywhere that's remote or regional. And if you wanted to do it in the city, yeah, sure, fine.
With the introduction of the carbon tax coming up, it looks like the Playford B station at Port Augusta, the old chugger, is going to shut down. And there are concrete proposals for solar thermal generation there by Beyond Zero Emissions. They argue that base load can be provided through storage of heat in molten salt. I'm just wondering if you could comment on that plan, because there is a national plan for that sort of thing, and whether you'd support that initiative.
I'm going to hand over to Barry, who's much more of an expert on this field, aren't you? And it's also a local thing.
They're arguing base load on getting, say, 15 hours of electricity storage equivalent so that you could cover night times and continue to supply energy. And I think these are part of the technology portfolio that we discussed at the summit is needing multiple demonstration plants around the world to try and look at different variants of the basic technology and look at cost of deployment of larger scale versions. So for the type of technology the Beyond Zero Emissions group are talking about, there is a demonstration plant that's been built in Spain, the Hemisolar plant, but it's only 20 megawatts, and so we'd need something about 20 times larger to replace that Port Augusta power station. And the cost for that first demonstration comes in at around $30 billion per gigawatt. So it's too expensive at present, and so you can't immediately go ahead and just replace a large coal-fired power station. The motivation for people who are arguing this on a large scale is that as you do, have a learning by doing process and build many of these plants, then those costs of $30 billion a gigawatt might come down to 5 or 2, in which case it really becomes a viable alternative. I think this underscores the fundamental ambition of the summit was to try and select those technologies from a range of different sources, be it solar or energy storage or new types of geothermal and new types of nuclear, and through multilateral agreements and demonstrations provide enough knowledge to demonstrate what is likely to be viable on a large scale and how those costs are going to be reduced. Otherwise, we just end up picking our favourite technology and saying, the costs will be there when it's needed, but not actually getting to the point where they are deployable.
Two things that arose out of the Equinox Summit, and you just reminded me that some of the reasons why we tackled certain technologies and not others had to do with prerequisites we went into. We thought we're facing a climate emergency, really, and we need, and these, and energy takes so long to get going, to a new power plant, irrespective of the type, takes so long to get up to speed. So we really didn't have time to dawdle and try favourite technologies. What we said was, okay, here are a bunch of technologies that have the potential to deliver solutions at 20 gigawatt capacity. So that was the marker. We had to think big, fat energy solutions. And it helped clear our minds. It had to be stuff that can be deployed at a large scale. We can't sit around talking about popular technologies. On the popular technologies front, it was interesting. A lot of conferences are about, you know, a bunch of solar people talking to each other and a bunch of nuclear people talking to each other and solar, hydrogen, etc. Rarely do you see each of these people talking across the aisle to each other as scientists and arguing with each other about the logic and, you know, applying critical thinking to they're familiar to doing it with their colleagues within solar, but then there's kind of an understood acceptance of solar. If they have to argue with a nuclear guy and convince the nuclear guy, there was some interesting discussion there. And a lot of people came to the conference, the forum in particular, came to the conference totally focused on getting endorsement for this particular technology. And what happened was they found that it wasn't, because they all came with thinking this is the brilliant solution that deployed all over the world and will solve all problems, right? You know what came out of it? That it's really applicable in this area, but maybe not so much in that area. Or this is how to integrate it into the system and actually solve all of the problem, but in an integrated fashion, not as a everyone do organic PV or everyone do nuclear. That wasn't the way to do it. And because they were scientists and they have to rationalize things, you know, the organic solar person would be presenting one day and he would then be attacking the next person who might be a nuclear person. So the nuclear guy had to think, well, I better not attack him. You know, I better be fair and try to find a solution for his because he's going to do the same to me. So it kind of forced people to talk across the aisle to each other. And because you had these advisors who were the, not all of them were so young, but we had these advisors who were experienced and understood technologies and engineering and industry, they were able to poke holes and make sense of it, you know, saying, well, yeah, that's a great idea, but it's not going to work. And then you had the young people who were pushing for change because this was their world that we were talking about. This is the world they're going to live. This is the legacy we're going to leave them. And they were adamant that it had to change. So it was a wonderful combination. And it led to, I think, some really interesting stuff.
I'd like to ask how much you challenged the model of centralised generation. So, you know, you say your short term is renewables with storage, and to the extent that storage can be accommodated by modern batteries can be in big lumps or they can be in very little small lumps all over the places where the energy is needed, and your smart grid can help deliver that. So how much was that sort of stuff explored?
Absolutely, smart grids are necessary for this world, particularly with the renewables stuff. Our grids are really dumb in that they kind of cycle power one way. We need grids that if you have solar in your house, it cycles it back, and it actually, the grid knows how much energy you're using, how much you're likely to use, and that's what we need across the board. And this kind of technology, this kind of deployment cannot be done without smart grids. It's not a case that we ignored that approach. We were being realistic about saying there's so much installed infrastructure in the developed world, we're not going to throw that away, yeah? There were some places where substations, for example, could be converted to superconducting substations and saving something like between 3 and 9%. And that doesn't sound like much, but for a city, that's a lot. So there were examples like that we looked at, but really replacing the whole infrastructure is not going to be doable unless, as the gentleman was suggesting, somebody, a community does itself. But where infrastructure is still under construction, we don't have to follow the Edison model of New York, 24 houses in 19, whatever it was, 01 or something, 18, I forget what it was, which would have been in the video that I would have played, by the way.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah, I've been enormously impressed. I'm absolutely delighted with this session. And partly because it seems to be beginning to address what seems to me to be the battle of the short term against the long term against the short term. So, for example, I've heard in other sessions here about how really what we should do is efficiency. Efficiency will have diminishing returns in a few years' time. If we put all our resources into efficiency, in the end, we'll come up against the limits. Carbon sequestration. Carbon sequestration will lead to the development of more and more coal power stations, which claim they'll be sequestering, and perhaps they will, but it still will absorb all the investment and all the research resources which are needed for the more long term. So I think that the approach which weighs all the things, because we need short-term solutions so we don't reach a tipping point unexpectedly. We need long-term solutions because the threat will persist for centuries.
Agreed.
So we need to find a balance. And up to now, it's very rare, as you've said, to find an attempt to balance the different timescales.
Because I think, you know, the decisions, the large-scale decisions are political decisions, and politicians get no praise for making decisions that will play out in 10 or 15 years. We need to, as citizens, encourage and reward those that do and punish those that don't. Because, you know, it's gone beyond a joke now. It's not a case of let's make it look pretty and dress it up. It's now a serious problem. We need to address these problems. And we didn't tackle carbon capture at all, because what is the point of targeting carbon capture if you're still... if you're still producing coal-fired power plants? Yes, there's lots of coal in the world, but let's not use it for that. it wasn't very popular with the forum either. We would never have got it past the forum. Like building another coal-fired power station, they wouldn't allow. I totally agree with them. We have no reason to. We have other technologies. You know, I wouldn't be. We're facing a climate emergency. Where I suspect, as an individual, not speaking on behalf of my organization, but as an individual, I suspect that in this century we're likely to see tens of millions of people die because of climate change, if not maybe 100 million. And it's not a case, you know, every time that we delay, and I'm not talking about targets or whatever, just let's deploy things that are logical and rational and make long-term sense. And this is why it's such a pleasure to deal with scientists who, if you actually release them from the shackles of political cycles and funding strategies, and just ask them to think about what's the most logical technical solution, guess what? They come up with really good stuff. Really do.
Please join me in thanking Wilson De Silva for today.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.